Welcome to episode 35 of the Upward Spiral podcast presented by Hypebot.com. Today on the podcast, we are talking with Ben Cesario, who reports on the changing landscape of the music industry for the New York Times. We're talking with Ben about how YouTube's plans for a music award show and a subscription music service might impact the online music sector, and why streaming music services more broadly haven't gained a foothold in the larger market. We are also going to discuss the Miley Cyrus outrage cycle. I am Kyle Blinn, a user researcher and technology writer at Live Nation Labs, a web and mobile product development group at the company.
And I'm Courtney Harding, a develop and manage partnerships at SoundDrop, a social music application for Spotify, web, and iOS devices.
As I said at the top of the show, we are joined by Ben Cesario of the New York Times. Ben, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Glad to have you. So,
all right, let's kick things off. So, Kyle and I are both ex-Billboard folks. We both wrote for them for a period of time. So we both know what it's like to work under an editor and pitch stories and that whole cycle. And there can be a lot of back and forth, and sometimes major changes get made to the story. So to start out, I kind of want to hear about your writing process and how it plays out for you and your role in the New York Times.
Well, I have editors too. I have a lot of them. And they change stuff also. I guess on some basic level, it's probably not a lot different from people who write for other publications, in that, I have my sources and I pitch my editors and we fight about things, and then things run and then people yell at me for them. But I think that I have kind of two distinct constituencies that I'm writing for and that I have to think about, and one is the music industry and people who are very knowledgeable about the things that I'm writing about, and the other is the general reader who probably doesn't know, or you have to assume doesn't know a great deal of detail about the topics, and may know nothing. So you do have to, it can be a trick sometimes to figure out what story is appropriate and what story is not appropriate, or what's too in the weeds versus what's actually a revealing detail about the way an industry works and the way it impacts normal people. So, that's one thing that often comes up between me and my editors about, is this inside baseball or not? And sometimes we disagree about that. But I think that's generally kind of the challenge.
Yeah, because, Kyle and I were both, writing for the music industry, and we were covering industry stories that very much were in the weeds. You have this interesting balance. So how do you, then what's your solution? Do you just sort of try to balance, okay, I'm going to do 50% in the weeds industry stories and 50% broader interest stories, or like how do you strike that balance?
That's not the way I look at it. I try to make every story comprehensible and meaningful. And, sometimes it's inevitably in the weeds, but, you try to write that lead in a way that explains it. And, especially as the digital music industry has developed, and, the issues that are demanding the most attention now, they're very much in the weeds, royalties and a lot of the legal issues about rights and copyright and downloads and streaming, whatever, this is really complicated stuff. And so you can't dismiss it as just, oh, that's just, all this stuff about Spotify and who gets paid and YouTube and who gets paid there and what are the rights. That's just, minutiae that nobody cares about. No, it's, in a way it's minutiae, but it's minutiae that is very meaningful and, impacts everything. So, this is a conversation that I wind up having with my editors a lot, where I'll say something and I'll say like, hey, you know, this is going on, this is a big deal, and you kind of get the glassy-eyed response of, you know, talking about mechanical royalties. And then you got to sort of go, oh yeah, this person doesn't spend their whole day, you know, reading Billboard and talking with, you know, I don't know, publishing sources or whatever. And so you have to think about the reader that doesn't know all of the, know all of the industry detail. And so I actually think it's a really useful exercise all the time to just like take a difficult subject and a subject that is not, you know, known by everybody, and try to explain it. And I think it's the same thing that a lot of reporters here have to deal with. You know, if you're covering, you know, healthcare or the tax code or something, like, you know, like when a 1,000-page tax bill is pushed through Congress at the last minute, you know, it has to be explained to people in 900 words, just like everything else. And so you have to figure out what is the key point, what are the disagreements, and what does it mean?
For sure. I mean, both with music royalty payouts and ticket bots, those are extremely technical subjects with different expert opinions that you're both trying to clarify and simplify, but also, and I'd love your take on this, by the New York Times kind of weighing in, you really have to get the story right and set the record straight, and maybe in a way that maybe other writers aren't as pressured to do.
I guess so. I mean, I think it's, I won't dispute. I mean, like, if I'm wrong, 1,000 people jump down my throat, you know, and it's a prominent mistake. But I don't know. I guess I dispute the premise that other writers don't have to get it right. I hope that, you know, I hope that people don't look at it that way. Maybe they do. I don't know. Maybe the average person writing about this in a blog just says, who gives a shit, and writes whatever they want. But the sourcing, you know, does have to be solid. And I mean, there are, you know, the way that news happens, you know, in this industry, as you guys know really well, is, you know, leaks happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some things are leaked for a reason, and they're leaked often because they will benefit one side of a deal, or they will hurt a competitor or whatever, you know, whatever the motivations are. And so, you know, I do have actual, you know, like guidelines about, you know, the sourcing of stories and trying to solidify things so that it's not just one source whispering in your ear. So, yeah, I guess I do have standards that I have to uphold, but I don't know. I still think that if Tech Blog X writes something that's just utterly wrong, its credibility is undermined and nobody's going to pay that much attention to it. And, you know, I think that naturally happens. And, you know, I'm sure in your head you can think of the sources online that don't have the rigid, systematic editing process of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, but do good work. And they do, you know, and the fact that they do good work again and again means that people learn to trust it.
Mm-hmm. I think definitely, I mean, you know, when I was writing for Hypebot, and when I still do to this day, like, because it is an industry-focused audience, there is such a pressure to, like, know, like, you know, if I'm going to write about Beats Music, Ian Rogers is going to read this, and I want to be insightful, I want to be fair, I want to be objective, I want to be well-reported, but I also want to be extremely critical, too. Like, I want to uphold a very strong sense of authority on the topic that, from any number of angles, stands. And it's not always easy to do that. Like, it does take a ton of research, a ton of sort of going back and forth with either your editor or just sort of arguing with yourself on the paper, trying to get the most fair, clear, concise words out. And that is an art itself. Like, I think I've seen, you know, sentences that you've written that might take me 4 to write.
Yeah, I'm glad you feel that way. I mean, I'm just glad to hear you describe it, because I mean, those are exactly my thoughts a lot of the time, and I think that those are probably the thoughts of any, you know, conscientious journalist who wants to do a good job, that, you know, that you're going to go through a process of being, you know, being the district attorney, beating yourself up and trying to think of, like, you know, what's the flaw in this argument? What's the trap door? What am I not seeing? How is this smart and tough but also fair? You know, I try to do that, and I think I don't know. I think anybody who's worth their salt, and is, you know, no matter what the publication they're writing for, that's what they're going to do. And I think, like, if somebody just, you know, bangs out some crap, then, you know, it's going to be clear, and so you're just not going to trust it. Mm-hmm. But I do think, I mean, I do agree with you that, you know, the Times, when the name of the New York Times gets attached to something and it spreads around, you know, it really does have to be right. And that's our credibility. And, you know, I think I get it right most of the time. But, you know, there are times I've gotten it a little bit wrong. I don't think I've ever been, like, horribly wrong. I hope not. But, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, you do the best you can, and with the sourcing that you have, and, like, sometimes things turn out a little differently than you thought. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, you make other kinds of missteps or mistakes. Like, for example, you know, holding on something because you have it, you know, pretty good and you think it's true, but you don't feel like you have the whole story. Mm-hmm. Or there's a voice in your head that's saying, I feel like there's more to this. And so you wait. And then at 8:45 that night, you know, your phone blows up and somebody else scooped you. And that's just part of the game.
Right. It's really interesting. I mean, we've been sort of talking about this idea of, like, when it's on a really technical subject like music royalty payouts or ticket bots, there is, like, a high degree of expertise that both you sort of need as a reporter to sort of be competent in the subject to then approach other experts and ask really insightful questions and try to synthesize all of that information together into a compelling, concise, simple narrative. I'd love to hear about, you know, when you're starting to incubate the idea for the ticketing bot story. I mean, that's a story that's been around for a little while, but it's becoming more mainstream. What kind of momentum gets behind that story, both to where you cover it and to where you feel comfortable covering it?
That one in particular, I mean, I'm fascinated by the world of ticket scalping, and, you know, in every way, and especially in the technology way, and, you know, ticket bots and all of the other, you know, sneaky technological aspects to the secondary ticket market now are things that I'm just very interested in and have been following for years. So, you know, you're right. I mean, it's been around for a little while. And, you know, there have been times in the past, like with the Miley Cyrus tour, you know, where actually, was it even a Hannah Montana tour at that time? Yeah, it was Hannah Montana, you know, like that was the billing. And bots kind of became the story there. But they're still the story. And it resurfaces from time to time. I don't know, your question was like, what's the critical mass of, like, why, when I feel like it's a story?
Yeah.
I feel like it's kind of always a story. I mean, in that one, the reason I felt like, that was an issue was because I knew that, Live Nation was pursuing this hard, or I guess technically the Ticketmaster side was pursuing it. And there were a number of cases, in years past, like maybe a year or two ago, where there actually was kind of head scratching among the ticket brokers about, why didn't Ticketmaster sue here? What's going on? And I think that in my reporting, it led me to learn that the reason that Ticketmaster did not pursue certain law enforcement, you know, avenues, in other cases, was that because they were considering a civil suit. and that they had felt that law enforcement had failed them. And a couple years ago now, I think, I wrote a story about the sort of lobbying war between StubHub and Live Nation, or between eBay and Live Nation, about the secondary ticket market, and about how there was the whole, this has kind of subsided a little bit, but the kind of like AstroTurf phony grassroots organization side to it, where they both had set up very confusingly similarly named organizations, the Fan Freedom Project and the Fans First Coalition. The Fans Freedom Project is still around. I think the Fans First Coalition, which was the Live Nation group, I haven't heard about anything about that in a while. But, you know, it was just about sort of how this, you know, what sounds like this kind of, or what the typical person might think of as this kind of like misdemeanor crime, you know, busting a guy for selling tickets outside Madison Square Garden, is actually this like multi-billion dollar high tech business where it's worth it to eBay and Ticketmaster to lobby around the country in multiple state governments and to really go at it hard. And, you know, as you know, there was the law in California that was recently passed. And I think it's been signed, right, about outlawing ticket bots. I don't know a ton of detail about that, but I mean, just the, you know, this is just something that's just sort of always bubbling. So I knew that Live Nation was pursuing, as you know, one tentacle of their overall strategy. You know, they were pursuing civil lawsuits. So so that was kind of the basis of my story.
So I kind of want to jump in a little bit and talk more about a much more mainstream story, but you alluded to it earlier, or to someone involved in it earlier, and that's Miley Cyrus. And this is something that I'm always really confused by because, you know, Miley with the twerking and the tongue and the this and the that, you know, it's clear that she's just trolling people. Like, it's very clear that she's a very intelligent young woman who grew up in the music industry, learned it at her father's knee. She's the one like sitting there with her team of social media experts plotting all this stuff out. And yet people are still really outraged by it. Like they're still clutching at their pearls. And no one seems to have figured out like this is all just manufactured outrage. Like this is all just made up. And this is all just people jumping on a bandwagon to drive page views and hits and Spotify streams. So I'm kind of curious as to why you think that people just can't really, like, there's this appetite for coverage of someone like Miley Cyrus, but people can't really figure out that it's all just sort of like made up to get attention as opposed to anything real.
As opposed to anything real. I don't know. I mean, I guess, and I don't really want to defend Miley Cyrus coverage because I hate it. I mean, I feel like it's a non-story and I'm tired of reading about it. And I think it's depressing how media perpetuates itself and perpetuates a story like this. Because I think you're right. There's the, you know, the page view trolling clickbait kind of aspect to it that we just see over and over and over again. So I don't know. I mean, I think like we've seen it happen before. We know exactly what's going on. And I mean, by we, I mean like, you know, people who I guess are either involved in the music industry or just savvy consumers of media. I do think though that the average consumer, I don't know what they think about a star, a performer doing something outrageous for the sake of publicity versus doing something outrageous because of some other reason. You know, and like in the case of like Kanye West or something, what's the difference? You know, I mean, his whole approach to his art and to his persona is about, you know, exploring the absurd side of celebrity and just going crazy with it. And I think that we, maybe there's a sexist side to it, but I think that, you know, we look at Kanye West as someone who's doing it in a very savvy way. And there's a sort of, you know, ingenious musical side to him. But, I mean, he's also just sort of making outrageous troll-like tweets all the time. And, you know, grabbing a mic away from Taylor Swift, which is just as stupid. So, I don't know. I don't think I have that... I don't think I have that great answer to your question, Courtney. But like you, I mean, I feel like, you know, I think it sucks. Like, I just it's not interesting, but it's also kind of interesting to just watch, you know, watch media happen.
I have this theory that it's a 10-year give or take outrage cycle. Because when I was a kid, the Madonna sex book was the big thing. And then when I was in college, it was Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and their tiny little outfits, and now it's Miley Cyrus. And I was thinking of it like, is there a 10-year window that most normal people have where they really care about pop culture, and then they sort of just grow out of it and forget it? So it's this constant newness of like, oh, another naked pop star, because they have no memory of the naked pop star 10 years earlier.
I like theories like that.
Okay.
You know, I go with it. But do you think that there hasn't been outrage about, you know, exhibitionistic celebrities in the last 10 years?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's always, it's like, it goes back to Elvis. I mean, I just feel like people have a very short memory span. Like, I.
But there's been nothing from Britney to Miley?
Nothing I feel like that's been as big in terms of like naked female pop stars. I mean,
what
there's
about
definitely...
Lady Gaga in the meat dress?
Gaga in the meat dress was a little different though, because the Britney's nakedness and Miley's almost nakedness were treated in this very sort of patronizing way, whereas Gaga in the meat dress was just sort of like, oh, she's quirky, like she's a different duck. It was a little bit more respectful. Like Lady Gaga can and does walk around pretty scantily clad, but because she handles herself slightly differently, people just think like she's a weirdo. But it's not like she's the least sexualized naked woman in pop music these days. If that makes any sense, which is not an insult, but she's operating on a completely different level. You know, yeah, there's probably been other naked pop star scandals that I've missed, but it seems to me like these have been sort of the big tent pole naked lady pop star scandals.
This is Courtney's first book in the making.
Yes.
Well, I mean, maybe it's like, you know, me showing my age, but I felt, did you read Camille Paglia's piece about Miley Cyrus? She wrote about
yes,
it.
Like, the and day I after. Wanted to jump off a bridge after I read it.
I agreed with her that I thought that it wasn't so much that there was a sexual norm that was being flouted or that, you know, that that was shocking the world as much as I just thought it was really lame performance. You know, I find it hard to believe that people turning on the television in 2013, you know, would go, a girl shaking her ass? What? You know, how are my children possibly, you know, survive? But it just was ridiculous. I mean, it was terrible. That was what was outrageous to me.
Yeah. She's not a very good dancer. I'll concede that point. She's a lot of things, and God knows she'll be running a record label in 20 years, but she's not a dancer, that one.
Whatever happened, like, it did the trick. I mean, you're right. Like, the end result is popularity, is eyeballs, is clicks, people hitting the button. And, that's what it's about. You know, I mean, that's pop. That's the purpose. So I guess on a simplistic level, you know, just like Elvis, you know, like, it got people paying attention.
So on this sort of topic of the button that people are clicking to view the Miley Cyrus videos, it's often YouTube, the most popular, widely available platform. It's expected that the company will reveal a subscription music service by the end of the year. This puts YouTube in direct competition with Spotify, Rhapsody, Ardio, among other rival services. In effect, I mean, YouTube is already the most dominant player, but it is entering a crowded market in that respect. Ben, what impact might YouTube have on the online music sector?
Well, you know, it might have a huge impact. I mean, it is the most popular digital music service, and there's, you know, hundreds of millions of people going to it all the time. And, you know, so much so that it's sort of become the platform where people can explode onto pop culture. But I scratch my head about this service, and, you know, that it doesn't, I mean, we'll see when it's ultimately unveiled, but it doesn't totally compute me. And the reason that YouTube is the dominant service is because it's free and because it's the depository of everything, and it hasn't been the property of record labels, and that's what they created Vevo for. And you know, we know that. You know, something like 90% of the views that Vevo gets per YouTube, because that is the portal. So convincing all of those people, or even a small fraction of them, to pay $10 a month, and we've already seen how difficult it is to get people to pay $10 a month for Spotify and all the others. I think it's a big challenge. I mean, things when you get to YouTube, things are at a really vast scale. So in the best case scenario, you know, this could tip the scales. I mean, this really could be huge. On the other side, it could be another flop. You know, it could be another Twitter Music. You know, that's one where it looked like, hey, you know, Twitter is everything. Everybody loves music. Rihanna's huge on Twitter. What could possibly go wrong? But we've seen this over and over where it kind of looks like, and you know, it kind of looks like an easy thing to just push the button and unveil one of these services. And it's not always, you know, it's not always so easy. And I think it's hard to get people to change their ingrained habits.
That's one thing I've noticed with the debut of iTunes Radio. And as much as I want to use the service, I just do have that little loop of like, click this button that produces that result. And I forget to open up iTunes to play the radio stations there. Like, right. The habits are so important.
And also, like, what is iTunes giving you that's all that different from Pandora?
I mean, I think they have a better take on popular music curation rather than just solely focused on sort of more custom radio. But I'm saying that as someone who sort of knows the difference, and even in user research projects, I've talked to people who love Spotify Radio more than Pandora Radio, even though arguably, you know, Spotify Radio is sort of a lesser experience, but they like it for different reasons, which it has fewer ads, more variety, similar interface, their friends are on there. I mean, you know, that's what's always provocative to me, is to talk to normal people about how they view and use these services, because it instantly gets you outside of the music industry bubble and allows you to see music as it exists in daily life.
I think that's very important. You know, I think of like my friends and my family as kind of the sounding board about that, where, you know, I don't think many of them, you know, first of all, you know, pay for a Spotify subscription. The few that have heard of it don't really know much about it, and they don't really know, you know, what's the difference between an on-demand subscription streaming service with a, you know, freemium tier and on the other hand, the few brand names that really have penetrated the mainstream about digital music are Apple with iTunes, YouTube, kind of as a default music thing, and Pandora. And Pandora is the only one there that's a sort of standalone company and that doesn't have, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars behind it. And I mean, it's amazing to me how they've done it, and how, I mean, the last couple of years, it's just astonishing how much it's grown, and how I do think that if you walk outside right now and, you know, ask 10 random people, have you heard of Pandora? Do you use it? Do you like it? Almost every single one of them probably will have heard of it, and probably a, you know, good chunk of them will use it and will say something like, yeah, I turn it on at home when I'm sitting around doing nothing, or when I have people over and I just want to put some music on, which is what, you know, which is its advertised purpose. And I think, you know, they've stuck it out for a long time and have perfected that product. Is it, you know, will Apple be able to steal that away from them? I don't know. You know, I mean, whenever there was, you know, for a good year there after the news kind of first leaked about Apple's plans for iTunes Radio, remember all that time when it was called iRadio? You know, every time there was a little bit of news, you know, Pandora stock would kind of flutter, you know, because the Wall Street of it is, here comes Apple, you're dead, you know. But it's not quite so simple. And I think that, you know, I mean, it's still only been a month or two. But I think we saw from the most recent Apple announcement that, you know, the number of new new users, or at least new like signups or whatever for the iTunes Radio, slowed down dramatically from the beginning. And who knows how many of those people are going to do it again. So we'll see.
So I want to ask about streaming radio, which you were just talking about. You know, the services like Spotify and RDO, and everyone I know in New York, LA, and San Francisco has either Spotify or RDO. Like, people have their preferences, but everyone in my sort of immediate circle has one or the other. But no one I know outside of those major media centers does. And especially older people, so people over 35 or 40 definitely don't. So I'm kind of curious as to why it hasn't really caught on in a meaningful way outside of a small population. And is it a failure in marketing, which is my personal theory, or is it just these services are too early, or they haven't been around long enough and in 10 years they'll be the norm, it just takes a while? Or why do you think the Spotify and RDO have not become sort of the default for most people?
I guess marketing has a role, but I mean, my own theory is that the product just isn't good enough. You know, I think that at this point, it's been more than a decade that there's been the, you know, the model. And I think that there, you know, for people who are huge consumers of music, things like Spotify are, you know, they're sort of like useful resources, and, you know, and they're, it's kind of the dream of the celestial jukebox of just like, you know, type in the name and it pops up. But I mean, I believe, just speaking as just a, you know, consumer, that they're just not fun places to spend time, that they're just, you know, they're not that appealing as destinations. I think iTunes actually kind of was. I think it's, you know, I mean, I guess it had the advantage of being kind of the only big one for a while, but I mean, it just, its slickness, was a big benefit. And I think, as much as I, you know, I use Spotify all the time, I use RDO all the time, and I try as many of the others as I can to, you know, just to sort of keep familiar with everything. But I just don't find myself all that dazzled with the sort of interface.
And where does something like Move Music come in? And that's Move, M-U-V-E, is part of the Cricket Wireless Network. And it has this like really huge audience, but almost no one ever covers it. It's not included in the same conversations as Spotify or RDO. And I think that's partially because their subscriber base is really not affluent. I mean, Cricket Wireless is pay-as-you-go cell phone, which is generally targeted in an audience that doesn't have a lot of money or good credit. So Where does something like that fit into this broader picture of streaming services?
Good question. You're exactly right about, you know, Move Music and Cricket. I mean, and they specifically target that, you know, that segment of the market. And I think that's a really savvy idea. And they've been successful. But I don't know. I don't have an answer of what that says for the whole picture. I mean, I guess it does challenge the idea that it's only, you know, affluent, young, media drunk people who are signing up for this. Maybe there are all kinds of other people out there who will do it if the service does what they want it to do. And, you know, I mean, Move Music, I guess, does what they need it to do. The people behind Move would, you know, they would often say that their consumer only has a phone. They do not have a computer. They do not have a tablet. And the phone is everything. And the simplicity of the service is what appeals to their customer. And so it's, you know, just sort of like download the song, pay a fairly small amount in addition to your, you know, in addition to your carrier cost. And I mean, by the way, that's a big part of it, is that they've done they've done it. And bundling has been a real issue for most of the other digital services. You know, they haven't been able to really bag the big, the big providers, the big telecom companies. Once that happens, maybe that will change things. If it happens.
I think Move Music is such an interesting case study, because whenever you talk to people in the music business and you're just like, yeah, you know, Move Music is the most popular service in the United States, and they go, well, I don't know anyone that uses it. I'm like, well, of course not. Do you ride Los Angeles Metro, you know, which I do these days? And you kind of get a broader sense of how everyone is on their smartphones. And like you said, if this is their single device, this is their point of access for music, games, media, and sort of personal connection. Like, it's their everything machine. And I think, you know, we in the sort of more technology lead trade journalist space oftentimes forget, you know, it's like on Spotify, Sean Parker is sort of quote unquote the most influential curator because he has all those followers. But would anyone of the sort of Cricket Wireless audience really recognize who Sean Parker is? And I'm not sure if they would, which sort of highlights how vast the chasm can be between this technology audience that, you know, loves audio and suffers through Spotify, but really can't even imagine a world where Move Music exists.
I think that's a good point. I mean, there's a bubble factor to, you know, to technology and to technology coverage, you know, to the media. And I think, I mean, the world around Silicon Valley is a very important example of that, in the same way that the world around New York media is, where, you know, what seems like a big deal here inside the bubble is not always a big deal outside the bubble. And there's, you know, there's kind of a madness that happens, and there are huge sort of problems that result when, you know, you'd think like, hey, what could possibly go wrong here? You know, everybody that I, you know, all my friends are into this. Why isn't the rest of the 300 million people in the country? You know, that's just, I guess that's just, you know, an industry has to figure out all the time, is just, you know, figure out the audience. The audience is not necessarily the person, you know, across the cubicle from you.
Mm-hmm. What about, I mean, so we've been talking about this idea of the challenge that these music services have in marketing themselves. the challenge that they have in making a product that people gravitate towards. And it seems like, you know, Beats Music with their coming service is really trying to answer many of these claims. You know, they have a whole bunch of artists, I'm sure, lining up to promote the service. I'm sure they have a very savvy firm that's going to put out really interesting marketing. And from what I hear, they're making a really, you know, cohesive, innovative, smooth product that can bring curated playlists to sort of your forefront right away. How do you feel like the entry of Beats Music will impact the market? And do you think they might be able to break through?
I mean, that's what they want to do. And there's a kind of, I don't know if you guys feel it too, but there's kind of this like pent up anticipation in the music industry about, you know, once Beats Music gets here, you know, then it's really going to get real. And we'll see. I mean, they're playing a hype game right now, and Jimmy Iovine is really good at that. You know, he's really, really, really good at that. And what they did with the headphones is just incredible. You know, it's like an incredible marketing, you know, that they've gotten thousands and thousands of people to buy $300 and $400 headphones and made it a fashion accessory. But you know, I really don't have much of an answer to the question, Kyle, because I mean, we just don't know. Like, maybe the service will be amazing and they will succeed where everybody else has failed. Maybe it'll be just like, you know, I think one of the things that happens here, I think, is that things that look really simple to execute are not always so simple. And the curation idea and the playlist idea, I feel like we've seen a lot of really uninteresting versions of those ideas, because they kind of look like, hey, you know, the Saturday night party mix, girls' night out, you know, Laurel Canyon, whatever. It sounds like it should be easy to throw together a few songs, call what you're doing curation, and say that is what people want. Interestingly, you know, what Pandora does is not curation. You know, it's an algorithm. And that's what people really like about it, I think, is it's kind of a game. And I mean, think also of, you know, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought, guys. But
it's all good. I think I have a good follow up, which is that, like, you know, I remember when I was still editing Hypebot, I wrote this story about how it's like, you know, the music industry service launch calendar, and it was like, you know, Spotify is on its way, Google Music is on its way, the rumored so-and-so is on its way, iHeartRadio is on its way. And it's like, once all of these things happen, then it will finally be happening. But the sort of truth is that it's happening now. And in many ways, the music industry feels almost addicted to the next big thing, the next silver bullet. And we keep reloading the gun, hoping it fires. And I'm not sure if the bullets are even real.
Did you write the piece about curation?
I've written several. I think I wrote Mainstream Fanatic that was on Songza, and then I also did one on Daisy that was called Daisy Chain.
Well, there was a piece on Hypebot maybe a year or so ago that was, you know, that was kind of debunking the idea of curation. Was that your piece?
Was it the debunking of music discovery?
Maybe that was it. I apologize.
If it was the 800 sort of fist about music discovery, that was definitely me. How it's solving a problem that no one has.
Yeah, I think that I apologize for mixing it up, but I thought that was a good. I thought that was a really good and provocative piece, because, you know, like curation, discovery is another buzzword that, you know, is thrown around as like that's the answer, that, you know, that's the answer to everything. That's what we're all waiting for. You know, when X service enters the market, they're finally going to solve that discovery problem. And this sounds like a pitch to investors more than a pitch to consumers, I feel. Because, like with the discovery issue, I don't feel like people are wandering around going, where's my curation? What am I going to do without curation? You know, they want the music, you know, they want the music there. They want it simple. I mean, look at YouTube, the chaos. And yet it's so popular because everything's on there and it's pretty simple.
So I wanted to circle back to YouTube now that you mention it, because I think there's one more question to sort of wrap up with. You know, YouTube recently announced that they're going to be hosting a music award show on November 3rd. You know, a lot of publications have suggested the timing of the award show and the timing of the subscription service are not a coincidence. You know, is this YouTube trying to sort of reposition itself away from being this like chaotic place where, yeah, if I search for any given song, I'll get the official video and then I'll get 100 videos of somebody's baby dancing to it or dog doing something cute to it or, you know, some kid playing a cover song in his basement. You know, what's YouTube trying to really do with this award show?
I think that they are sort of trying to reposition themselves, but I think that YouTube wants to both be the chaotic place for the, you know, the wedding video and the dog on a skateboard, as well as the you know, the money making video. And I mean, so far their attempt to do that with the channels that they launched at the beginning of this year, you know, it has not been a resounding success.
I completely forgotten about that until just now.
Yeah, you know, that's a big deal. And that was, you know, that was like, you know, a strategy at the very top of Google, and I'm sorry, at the very top of YouTube, maybe Google too, of what is YouTube all about? How are we going to make money on this and pitch this to other people so that they can make money too? And, you know, the result, I think, is that, yeah, a lot of the people who have put, you know, the official channels on there are getting the views, but it's kind of more the viral effect. You know, I mean, whether it's on an official channel doesn't really matter. It's still just that, you know, sometimes there's a spark and it lights something on fire and it just happens. So I don't know. I think that YouTube is trying to juggle a lot right now, and you know, they're big and they're powerful. Maybe they'll be able to do it, but maybe you know what people want out of YouTube is you know different from what YouTube wants to be.
That's really well said, Ben. Thank you so much for the kind words and for joining us tonight in the show. If people want to find your writing at the New York Times or look you up on Twitter, where can they find you?
The Twitter account is my last name, SISARIO. And, you know, I don't have like a, you know, I don't have like an efficient hub or something. I guess they can just type it into the search field.
I understand you also had a book that came out a while ago too, though.
I did. I wrote a book about the Pixies.
Oh, nice. And it was called Doolittle?
Yeah, it's in the 33 and a third series. And please buy 10 of them and give them away to all your friends for Christmas.
I think all of the Upward Spiral listeners will definitely do that. Well, that's all for this episode of the Upward Spiral. Thanks so much to Hypebot.com for putting this podcast out. If you have any questions or comments, email us at upwardspiralpodcast@gmail.com and be sure to follow us on Twitter at upwardspiralpod. Don't forget to subscribe in iTunes, and if you like the show, please rate us highly and submit a review. Thank you very much.